It's Song Talk Radio with Michael, Neil, Phil, and the gang.
Welcome to Song Talk Radio. This is the show with songwriters talking to other songwriters about the craft of songwriting most of the time. We share tips, tools, and techniques, and together we all become better at writing songs. I'm your host, Neil Modi, and with me are the liquefied members of the Song Talk Radio action team. We have Fjord Phil.
I am very moist.
Good.
I guess.
Information, but okay. And we have Molten
Mike. You started
Mike.
It.
Molten. Well, that's Ooh. Nice because there's a lot of active volcanoes in the world right now. There's one in Iceland and one in St. Vincent down in the southern
Caribbean. And we love them all, just like you, Mike.
And it's just fascinating watching lava happen. Anyway, so I appreciate that. Thank you very much.
You're very welcome. And we're happy to have Delta Dawn with us.
Oh, Delta Dawn. I don't know about that one. There's a joke. I'm not going to say it on the air.
There's a song.
Oh, no. I'm going to liquefy.
We'll save it for the after.
Well, there was a song.
Delta
you
Dawn.
A song out of yours.
Oh, yeah. Delta,
Delta Dawn. You changed the words.
Delta Dawn, what's that?
Mechanism.
What's that flower you have on?
Flower you have on.
That's right.
It'll be a faded rose from days gone by.
Oh, boy. Things we come up with. In the meantime, please send your comments and questions to at Song Talk Radio on Twitter, Facebook, or Instagram, or feedback at songtalk.ca, and we'll share them on the show. And please visit us at songtalk.ca to find out how you can be a guest. Tonight, there's no guests, but we got a little bit of housekeeping items to do. Mike, you got some news for us?
Oh, well, just speaking to what you said, contact us through the website, songtalk.ca, and let us know if you'd like to be a guest. And we've been getting a lot of people sending in some stuff. I just want to give a brief shout out to the other side of the world. Bradley McCaw sent in a lovely track. He's a singer-songwriter from Australia, which is a fairly big country, so I don't know if he could be more specific. Anyway, so we might... hopefully we can arrange the time zones and try to get him as an upcoming guest. We've had a few others, and we're going through that. But the bottom line is, please send in your songs and contact us and let us know what you're up to. We'd love to hear from you.
Yeah, certainly we enjoyed it a few months ago when we did a batch of our listeners' songs and do a little analysis and feedback on them. So we do encourage you guys to send in your stuff, and we're happy to do another episode like that for sure.
And even if you have questions, you know, if you have any questions or issues you want to be brought up, let us know because we can research that and hopefully get a guest on that knows what they're talking about.
Yeah. And we do have a new doohickey on our website. If you look on songtalk.ca and find on the sidebar, there's a Q&A section we have. And we invite you to send in your questions via that form and we'll collate them all and research them and come up with some reasonable answers. whatever's brimming on your brain, you want to know something more about, we can certainly help you out with that.
Yeah, definitely.
Yeah, it's been the great thing about being in these little boxes in a virtual studio is we're making contact from people around the world, and it's great to hear different styles of music and different approaches, but also how much we all have in common.
That's very true.
We are the world.
Music, the great unifier.
True.
And Mr. Phil Emery, you were mentioning last week about how you're having a little bit of trouble with your new electronic drum kit.
Yeah, so I got the new kit from Donner Music. And, of course, it's a very cheap one. It's $350 US, which turns out to be $460 Canadian. But that's actually delivered, so that's, you know, fairly cheap. So it came out. Yes.
It's an electronic drum kit. That's right.
It's an electronic drum kit with mesh heads. And it came just before the show last week. And or was it the week before? I don't know. So I've had a chance to play with it a bit more. So some feedback on that. The actual hardware itself is – the quality is fairly decent. I mean, it's not super light. It's – you know, the plastic, you might be a little bit risky. When it comes with the drum key, I would be cautious about, you know, over-tightening. But so far, it's been okay. But there is one issue with the actual unit that makes the noise. And it's pretty clearly defective. Like only one of the buttons actually lights up when you press it. Mm. One of the other buttons doesn't do anything at all. And another couple of issues. And I don't have a problem with that because, well, for one thing, when you're dealing with something that's cheap, very often the quality assurance can be a little bit sketchy. But you can even have lemons from, you know, brands like Apple, and you pay a big price premium for Apple's brands. So mm-hmm. even Apple can have, you know, a bad unit from time to time. So I have no problem with that. But they have not been terribly responsive in correcting it. So it's been taking a bit of time. Maybe that's COVID. Maybe they just don't want to send me a new audio unit. But so before you buy that Donner website, which we do, or Donner drum set, which we did link to on the website last week's show notes, maybe just hold off, maybe until next week, until we get some resolution on this, because I'd hate for you to buy it and then it not work, and then, you know, you're kind of screwed. It does make noise, but it's a little bit, you can't really, because one of the buttons doesn't work, you can't actually adjust the sounds, which is a bit of an issue. So maybe just take a pause on that until next week, and I can give you a definite yay or nay.
Hopefully the company gets back to you. I mean, that's like you say, Apple, but you have a problem with an Apple product, they sort it out for you, like you split.
Yeah.
Mostly.
Yeah.
most responsible retailers do
yeah.
that.
Yeah.
And most Best Buy is really good about it and et cetera, et cetera.
Yeah.
But I just, you're being very kind, Phil, because you're saying, well, it was kind of cheap and you bought it and you were forgiving about that. But, you know, you spend your money. Something should do what it said it was going to do, regardless of the price, whether it's cheap or not. So I think.
Well, not only that, but I think it's, you know, if
it was
someone,
a couple hundred bucks.
Well, it was $400, which, you know, again, is cheap for an electronic drum kit. But if people didn't, if someone got it and they didn't know much about electronics and it didn't work, they wouldn't know necessarily that it didn't work. It's just, you know, people, you know, they'd go through the manual and the buttons wouldn't function the way they're supposed to. And people tend to think, oh, that's, I just don't understand how this thing works. It's my fault. And in this case, it's, you know, it's not that. So that's a bit concerning. But hopefully by next week, we'll have resolution.
All right. Fingers crossed for you, man.
Yeah.
All right. Speaking of pressing buttons.
Pressing buttons. Today, we're very happy to have Don Thompson return with us. Don was, or is, still our in-house tech person for the before times when we could gather at the downtown Toronto radio station to broadcast the show live. He's amazing with technology and audio engineering, and he's got the most bomb home studio I've ever been to. So welcome back to the show, Don.
Happy
to have you with us, because tonight we're talking about tips for helping you guys out with your DAWs, with your digital audio workstations. That is the software you use to record in your home studios. And as well as all four of us, in fact, are songwriters, as everyone knows, we're also all four of us home studio enthusiasts with our own home recording studios. So to start the show, I'd just like to go around the Zoom. Get that? We'll go around Zoom, and each of us can talk a little bit about where, like, our history with our home recording studios and then how long we've been doing it and all that sort of stuff. Mr. Phil, you want to go first?
Yeah, I was waiting for that.
Thank you.
Took me a while to get
that from your
open.
Donner.
Yeah, that's from the Donner. It works.
It's true.
Except he triggered it, you know, 3 minutes ago.
That's true. Exactly. That was from last
time delay.
Week. Actually,
a bit of a delay. Latency issue.
So I've already forgotten the question. What was the question?
How long you been doing the home recording studio thing, and what software do you use? And
well, it's interesting. My story is a long and complicated one. So I actually started getting into recording on my own, I think when I was like 14 and 15, I actually had, my father had an old reel-to-reel tape, And so I do stuff with the reel-to-reel tapes. I got really into electronic music very early, like the old electronic music, which is, you know, soundscapes. And I used to sneak into York University electronic music studios on the weekend because no one would use it. And I'd use their, you know, their $30,000 Buchla systems and, you know, these huge Roland systems. It was brilliant. So I got into it, and I was very much into that, and I even worked from that. I actually got a job at a recording studio in Toronto called Eastern Sound and worked there for a bit. And then I kind of fell out of it for a while and was still playing in bands, but I guess I didn't have room for like for, you know, I still had my tape machine, but I just didn't do anything with it. And then I think when sort of one of my major-ish kind of bands – broke up. I kind of sort of thought, well, maybe I should look into this electronic stuff. And I was into electronic music before MIDI. So MIDI actually didn't exist. So you could plug stuff into each other, into like synths into other synths, but they were all control voltages. And sometimes the the voltages didn't kind of match up. So they do all sorts of really cool things. So I had a lot to learn actually, because, I had worked with tape machines before, but, I didn't really know how MIDI worked and, getting used to, working with primitive DAWs, which was like Studio Vision by Opcode way back when, and, very early version of Cubase. And I really didn't know anything about it. And it was actually an interesting experience having actually been sort of like a bit of a whiz kid where, you know, I could talk to other engineers and I'd go, wow, you know a lot for, you know, a 15-year-old, just sort of like knowing nothing again. And so what I did is I would buy Future Music magazine every month and I'd read through it. And I would not recognize a lot of the stuff a lot of the terminology they wrote about. But I knew if I kept on reading those magazines, eventually I would. And I guess that was about in 2000 when I got back into it. And sort of been doing my own stuff ever since with varying levels of success, I think.
Okay. Excellent. And you're a Cubase user now.
I am. I still use GarageBand sometimes because it's very fast to put down a sketch. But Cubase is my main one. And the reason I got Cubase was actually because my very good friend and another fine songwriter, Archie Hughes, who was a keyboardist for many of my bands, he used Cubase. And I said, what DAW should I use? And he said, use Cubase, because that's what I used. And that's my first tip, is find the DAW that your friend uses so that you have someone to ask for advice about how things work, because that could really help, especially in the days before the internet when it was harder to get answers.
Okay. How about you, Mike? Where are you at?
Definitely not as detailed a journey at all. I only recently graduated from GarageBand, but I guess my studio experience was more making movies and doing the sound production of that. But actually just when I played in bands, we were pretty hopeless in the studio. A number of reasons for that would be slanderous if I were to repeat them. So it wasn't until I was just playing solo that I got a little more interested in capturing my songs down. But I started in GarageBand, and I only recently graduated to Logic about 2 years ago or so. And for me, it's just trying to capture the song and then make something more of it. Like if I'm playing a song live sounds like this. Once I get into a studio, I'm not trying to make it sound the same. It's more of, okay, it's like working in a dark room. You know, you can take a photograph and it's just a photograph, or you can take the negative and bring it into a dark room and do a whole bunch of more stuff. And that's how I approach working in the studio. If you're in the studio, do what the studio lets you do. So I'm still on at the very beginning of a journey of discovery. And I totally take to heart what you're saying, Phil, because Don has been really helpful in helping me solve some of the early mysteries of Logic. So I appreciate that, Don. For me, like the basic tip because if you do number of takes and everything, is just media management is crucial. Label everything distinctively, and right from when you start with an idea, just give it some distinctive name so you don't end up with 100 guitar track one, guitar track two. you'll never figure that out. So media management, regardless of what DAW you're using.
Okay, and how about you, Don? You've been at this a long time, I think.
I started late 80s, early 90s. I was in a band. I wasn't recording at the time, but it kind of let me down the whole what we call GAS, gear acquisition syndrome. So it started with guitars, and I had feedback problems. I had to change pickups. Then I started building guitar rigs. I lugged around a Fender Twin. And if anybody knows what a Fender Twin weighs, it's like 80 or 90 pounds, and a Marshall 4x12 cabinet and a head. And I had dual amp setups and all this, and I had a effects unit and everything. Anyways, as musicians usually do, musical differences come up, and hey, I don't want to be in your band anymore. But I, at that time, I started doing the backup singing, and I started getting into singing a lot more. And I thought, you know what, I'm going to set myself up some recording equipment. So I started out on tape, 8-track machines. But not long after that, as Phil alluded to about the friend, what do you use for a DAW? Well, they use Logic. And back in those days, Logic was owned by a company called eMagic, not Apple, and they had the Windows and the Mac versions. My two friends were on Mac. I used to build my own computers, so I was on a PC. And then eventually, well, we all know what happened. Logic was bought up by Apple, and then I kind of went to the Apple side or the dark side. I don't know. Light side, dark side, who knows? One side or the other. And that's when I started getting more and more seriously into it. Like, I was using MIDI back with my guitar rigs that I used to build, but then I started getting more and more into it, and I started out with a little card that could only record two inputs at a time into Logic. It was an actual card made by eMagic, which was the company that owned Logic. And then from there, it just kept growing, and then and it hasn't stopped. And this is, it still hasn't stopped. Something you mentioned about Phil, Michael, you mentioned something about labeling everything correctly. And another thing to do is when you're doing a bunch of takes, I always tell people, because I made the same mistake, comp it while you're doing it. Don't leave it and come back to it the next day. And then you're like guessing, oh, is that the better vocal? Is that the better one? Because sometimes there's a feeling that you have, like, that was a real good take. And that little piece from that other one I did was perfect. You come back to the next day and you sometimes forget about that. And then you've lost it. You know, where was I, right? Comp things down, and it also keep things cleaner. So back to that media management thing.
Oh, yeah, right? Absolutely.
So yeah,
and make notes, too. Make notes as you're going.
Logic has notes in it. Have you used those before, Michael?
Why no, Don? I've been using pen and paper like an animal.
There's a little thing up in the top right corner, and you can put track notes, so specific to that track, or you can put notes for the whole project. So you can even put all the lyrics in there if you want. You can, and then in the track note, you can say, I use this Telecaster with this amplifier and roughly these settings. So if you ever want to go back and get that sound again, you have a place to start. It's never always the same.
That's good. And how about you, Neil? What's your story?
So I go back to my teenage days as well. I started out with my first keyboard was like a Yamaha DX27, I think, keyboard that had MIDI in and out. And so I got a MIDI interface for, at the time we had an Amiga 2000 at home, Commodore, and this big honking box that would connect with MIDI. And we had a program called Music X. So I spent many years just recording multi-timbral parts through the keyboard. Eventually upgraded to a Roland D70, which actually gave me like five parts plus a drum part. I was like, wow, six channels. And it could record, you know, these sort of experimental instrumental pieces. And then a couple years after that, I think by the time I was 17, I got myself a little Dr. Rhythm drum machine, which I could wire through the MIDI. And I kept at that for quite a number of years, all through the 90s and stuff. And then it was in the early 2000s, actually got like, finally got a microphone and an actual audio interface that could capture real, guitars and vocals and things like that. And it was the same thing. I talked to a friend of mine and they were like, Cubase, what's Cubase? Okay. And dude gave me a copy. And I started using it on Windows. And then a few years later, I actually decided to properly invest in real software and bought Cakewalk Sonar at that point, mostly because at the time, my girlfriend at the time was a student, so she could get a student discount on it. So I used her account to get a student discount on it, which was pretty good. And I found it more user-friendly and just understood it a little bit better, easier. And I've been with Cakewalk ever since. And it's gone through a number of owners. Roland had it for a few years, and then they sold it to Gibson. Gibson dropped it in 2017 or 18 without any notification whatsoever. And
as Gibson does with everything.
Yeah, apparently Gibson does that a lot. And then a lot of users ported over to Studio One or something else. And but those of us that stuck with it, a lot of people come back because a company called BandLab picked it up and then offered the flagship version of what was Sonar Platinum without all the third-party plugins that were included before, but offered it for free. And it's still to this day perfectly 100% free, not Reaper free, where they ask you for $60, but you don't have to pay. It's actually freeware software, and it is, you know, fully fledged, fully featured DAW that, you know, kicks it up with the rest of the boys. But if you download BandLab by Cakewalk by BandLab, it doesn't have a lot of like really nice premium level plugins, instruments and things like that built into it. You can get, you know, free ones that are arguably better. And then you can, whatever money you were going to spend on a DAW, you can sink into some good instruments and stuff and have a good studio going with that way.
Some people really, people are terrible. It's common to, you'll find on the internet, people sort of arguing about which DAW is better. Yeah. And really none of them are better. No. The best DAW or digital audio workstation, which is what that stands for, the best one is the one that makes sense to you. And it doesn't matter what, you know, your favorite star uses. As an artist, you want to have a tool that is easy for you to understand and for you to actually get your stuff happening, because that's really what it's about. It's not about how good the fidelity is, because probably, you know, unless you're a true professional, you're probably not going to know really what the difference in audio is. So any kind of difference isn't going to be that noticeable to you. It's more about getting your ideas down into a form, in what, using a tool that you understand and that makes you want to create.
Yeah. I always say the best DAW is the one you know how to use.
Yeah. Right?
The one that you can actually sit down with and make music. I always use the analogy of a carpenter. Like, you can have, even if there is a quote unquote best DAW and you perceive it as such, you can have like the world's greatest hammer in the world, but that doesn't mean you know how to build a cabinet.
That's true.
Right. You can have the greatest, you know, precision sable brush, but that doesn't mean you know how to paint a watercolor.
Right? That's true.
Like, well, you know, it's just like we talk about songwriting. It's a tool in your toolbox like any other. And it really depends how you use it. And again, the big wins when you're recording at home is your song, your performance. Are your instruments in tune? Where do you place the mic? All the stuff that has nothing to do with what software you're using. If you get that right, no one cares what software you're using to record. If you got a great song and a great performance, they're 90% of the way there. You know what I mean?
It's true, because, I mean, I was talking about, I was using GarageBand. I'd started with Pro Tools, but it was so difficult to get up to speed with someone new to it that I wasn't using it. Whereas GarageBand, easy to use. So that was, you know, it's like, but some famous photographer said about a camera, said the best camera is the one you have with you, you know, because then you're going to take a picture when you see something good. And the best recording software is the one that you feel comfortable about getting too quickly and feeling you can get the sound you want.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well,
and then
logic,
yeah, it comes down to how you record. Yeah.
Logic is GarageBand is like a scaled down Logic. Like when you first buy Logic and you open it up, you got to go and tick all these boxes to turn all the pro stuff on. Otherwise, it actually kind of just looks like GarageBand.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Interesting. You
know, I've ticked all the boxes except the surround box because I don't really do mixing and surround, so I really don't want that clouding things. But But GarageBand's pretty powerful too. It's really great.
Yeah, I've known a lot of people to use GarageBand, and it's free if you've got a Mac, and it's perfectly good. And again, if you're on Windows, BandLab, Cakewalk by BandLab is free, so you really have no excuse not to get started.
That's true.
On something like this.
Yeah.
And even the interfaces to get you into, you know, in between your computer and what you plug your instruments or your vocals or your mic into, those can be very simple and very cheap, a couple of $100. So the financial obstacle to recording your music is not that great.
Not what it used to be.
No,
like that 8-track tape. Did you have like a Tascam 8-track?
Oh, I had a 4-track. Tascam 4-track.
Yeah, I had an R8, a quarter-inch. Yeah.
Oh, quarter-inch, right?
Yeah, I still have the tapes in the machine, but everything the tapes need to be baked in order, and whether the stuff on it's still good, who knows?
when I was in high school, I was in a rock band, and we rehearsed in one of my friends' basements. And we used to put a ghetto blaster in the middle of the room and sort of keep it as far away from me as a drummer as possible and recorded our songs that way, right? Just as rehearsal things, right? And it sounded really harsh and nasty, but it sounded like us, right? And then one weekend we decided to rent a proper 4-track recorder, and it didn't use large tape. It used audio cassettes, right? Yeah. And then we tried recording on it, and it sounded terrible. It was dull. It was lifeless. It just felt, we were like, screw that, man. Get the ghetto blaster back in here. It worked so much better. I don't know what we were doing wrong, but that was like the first recording experience. We did go into a proper, I think it was called Studio 92, if you guys remember that back in the day. I don't know, Studio 92. It was in the East End somewhere in Toronto. And did 3 songs in a day. And
sounds like a nightclub to me.
Yeah. It was a basement, of course. And and record all that to tape.
I would like to maybe we could start off with file management, because I think that's critical. Because just to let people know that even an experienced person could, what happens is you lose stuff. And our outro music, which is a song I was working on, I have lost all the tracks for that because of I would very often, when I'm practicing or if I come up with an idea, I'll just open up a project, and the project is called Untitled. So I recorded a bunch of stuff and then kind of saved it. And then, of course, a couple of years go by because I'm working on multiple songs at once because I get distracted. And I was wanting to clean stuff out. I don't know why. It's not like I was running out of room, but I just, you know, I think, oh, I'll just clean this stuff out. And I cleaned out the audio for this. And then I was thinking, oh, I want to, you know, want to start working on this song. And turns out I can't find any of the audio. So I've come up with a solution, which I think works pretty well, is every time you open up a project, and I used to just kind of like, you know, save the project and just like mash my hands on the keyboard. So everything was called whir, 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 or gluggable. And the problem is that in 3 years' time, you don't know what that is. It's just larble. So what I started doing is actually naming the projects by the date. So the projects would be, for today, would be 2021-04-13, if it's the 13th, I think. And that way I just sort of know what that file is. And if I know, oh, I was doing something cool last week, well, last week was, you know, that, so it kind of, I don't have to worry about giving it a name. It doesn't take any thought. It's a system that's easy to follow. And so, like, say you want to do something that you can track, because otherwise you will lose a really good performance, and you'll be very sad.
Yeah, I had See, in Cakewalk, it's a it used to be a little bit weirder than it is. I think now it defaults to you click new project and actually takes you to your song folder that you specified in the preferences. This is where my songs live on your computer. And you have to type in a name, and it automatically creates a folder and saves the Cakewalk file in there and creates another folder within there called audio, which is where it saves anything that you record. There is also a global audio setting in Cakewalk that if you do what you say, Phil, and just hit new and cancel that file creation thing, and it just opens up a blank session, it will just default to the global audio folder. And I had an incident a few years ago, and I'm not entirely sure what happened, but I think it was that sort of a session that I had that I didn't open like a proper file. So it ended up saving it to my C drive, which in Windows is like your system drive, as opposed to my documents drive, which is a separate drive that gets backed up properly and all that sort of stuff. And I had an uncle who was visiting us from India, my dad's youngest brother, who's a superb classical Indian singer. Right. And he wanted to do some karaoke things. Like he had a CD of karaoke stuff. So he imported it all in the Cakewalk, set up a microphone, had him record a bunch of songs. And he's like, great. And I said, I'll do some mixing on this and I'll email them back to you. And I think what ended up happening is my computer actually crashed the week after, and I had to go back and reinstall Windows. And when I reinstalled Windows, it wiped the C drive. And because those recordings were actually saved in the global audio folder, I completely lost them. And it's probably going to be years before I see this uncle again. So I was like, oh, man, I'm so sorry. I don't know what happened. It just I thought I saved them to the proper drive, and then it got lost somehow. So stuff does happen. So, yes, I fully... Yes. So nowadays, even if I don't know what the title of the song is, I'll create a folder and a file in Cakewalk and say, this is, you know, song for the Song Talk Songwriting Challenge 2021, enter, right? Give it some kind of a name, give it some kind of thing. You can always save as a different thing or rename it afterwards. But yeah, descriptive file naming and saving in the correct location.
Oh, that's huge.
And backing up.
And back it up. And now I back up everything. My PC drive gets backed up. My documents, everything gets backed up. So I've learned my lessons.
Backing up is very important because it's not a question of if your hard drive crashes. It's a question of when. So it will happen.
They will crash. Yeah. I've had drives go down before and I managed to capture it in time. And also if you're working on audio, especially if you're working on it professionally, it isn't backed up unless it's in three places, not two, three.
Yeah.
Right. So that means you have like two other physical backups somewheres, or maybe one of them is a cloud perhaps. Yeah. So
that's always, good in case your house burns down.
Well, it depends. If you're doing it for a business, then it's becomes more paramount for that.
Yeah.
Sure. Also, one thing that you might want to do is, like, you know, Cubase does the same thing. When you make a new project, it asks you to, you know, choose a folder. You know, you make a folder, then it does, you know, it creates like folders for audio and pictures and other stuff. Is very often most DAWs come with audio assets. So they'll come with drum loops and instrument loops or vocal samples or something like that. And you might use those in your song. And of course, you're absolutely perfectly free to do that. It's part of the package. And they're copyright free, so you're able to use them in your program. But if for some reason in a couple of years you lose that hard drive, those samples may not actually be in the same audio folder as the stuff you freshly record, because it's resident actually in the DAW's file system. So what you want to do is, in Cubase, it's called backing up project. And what that will do, it'll take all the audio that you've used in your project, no matter where it's located on the disk, and then copy it along with all the files, the program files, into a folder you specify. And that means that you can take that and you will actually have, that's a complete working copy of your project. And that's especially if you're done with the song, it's a good idea. Mm-hmm. Because you may want to look at it 10 years and you won't be able to.
Yeah. It's a good idea. I personally don't do this necessarily, but it's a good idea when you're, especially when you're done a project, is to go and export all of the tracks,
yes,
as individual audio files, especially if you're using like software instruments, which, you know, you open the file up 5 years from now and maybe you don't have that instrument installed anymore, or it tries to find it and they can't find it. And you wonder, which piano was that? Which synthesizer was that? I have no clue. Which, okay, incidentally, it's a good idea to take notes.
To I've record had all that those, happen. All
those information. But it is a good idea to export every little track as a pure WAV file or IAF in Mac world. So that if you do want it, at least you have the audio. You may not have the MIDI data necessarily, but if you want to do a remix or take a snippet of something, and it will pull all those things like you're talking about, fill loops and drum loops and things like that that you've used, and it will pull it out and dump it into a central location that you can back up and all the rest of it. One thing I did do with file management when I did my electro pop EP last year was I export. So if I was using Massive, for instance, for one of the patches, I would go into the Massive plugin, file, save as, save that patch to the same project folder.
Mm.
So I got another folder. There's audio. There's also a folder in each of those songs called patches, and give it a name. Said this was on the Massive plugin. This was what track it was used on. It was the bass. And that's it. Right. And went through every single plugin that I used and saved the patch so that if, and you know, something goes haywire and I need to find out what synthesizer I used back then I can always just browse to the project folder. And there they are.
Oh, good idea. I have a more creative question for you guys. Mm-hmm. When you start a song, what is the process? Do you start with like a sketch that you then play to? Do you start with the drum beats? Like how do you create a song? If it's even the same way each time. Phil, how do you go about when you start a song in your project? What do you start with? Or do you have a regular way of going about it?
Well, there's recording, and for the most part is a separate thing to the songwriting. Although sometimes I will open up a Cubase project and do a track, just like a dance track or something. But usually, what happens is I will most of my songs come from practicing. So I'm practicing the guitar, the bass, or the piano or something. Something will come up, and that'll sort of generate an idea. And then I kind of will sort of bounce that idea around in my head and play it acoustically. And then usually only later will I actually sit down and record it. But although it's a good idea to record stuff, at least on your phone, so that you at least have a record of it. Otherwise, everything is in my brain, and that's not good because, I only have so much room.
So then the creative process, like not the writing part, but the recording part, the creative recording part, do you have a set process for that, or it depends on the kind of song?
I will usually start off with a drum beat to play to, figure out maybe what the tempo is. And then I would actually often just work with loops, find a loop that sort of has the basic sound that I'm looking for, and loop that for, like 500 bars or something. And then just start recording the tracks to that. And for me, the vocals are always usually the last.
Mm-hmm.
But I'll do the guitar, Don, and vocals.
And Don, what's your...
Yeah, how I go about it? I don't think I approach it from the same way all the time. It all depends on the song. But much like Phil, I'll usually get a drum loop to play to, unless there's a drummer in the room. But sometimes I will just get my acoustic guitar out and I'll just play it in. And if it sounds like it's sort of in time, I can grid it after the fact. Because in your DAW, you can tell it to listen to your actual performance and it'll figure out where the transients are. And then it'll grid it. And then from there, you can drag loops in. And the loops will align themselves just perfectly, because even though the BPM might be moving, the grid will look the same. So it's another different approach to doing things. But for the most part, yeah, usually get a loop, acoustic guitar half the time. Although I've been writing on electric a lot more lately. So that's how I approach it. And then I'll have like patches. So I have a drum kit back there, and sometimes I'll get on the kit. And to make things a little faster, I don't really start with a template. at all because I don't know what the song's going to be about. However, I will have like set templates because it's a real pain in the ass setting up all the mic lines and all these various things for, especially when there's 12 mics on there. So I'll have a little things preset up and I'll just open up an audio file and then I'll grab the preset. It'll drop it on and it'll blow it out into all the tracks. I hit record, it'll arm them all, and then I just jump back there and play something. And I do that sometimes with recording electric guitars and acoustics as well, because a lot of times I'll sometimes double or triple mic things, and depending on the song. And it's just a lot quicker just using the little presets. But yeah, and then vocals probably, yes, last.
That's interesting, using presets. Presets is a good idea. Oh, yeah. Neil, yeah. How do you go about it?
So lately it's been more, I've been writing lyrics first kind of thing. So for the first part of a song, I'll have like a Google Doc floating around on my phone, on the computer, whatever. When I have a bit of a lyric done, I'll print it out, set it on my music stand, sit down at the piano. And sometimes I'll just open like a session of Native Instruments Contact with my default piano loaded up. And I can play along, try to come up with the melody, whatever. And if I'm really pressed for time and I don't want to bother setting up a proper microphone, I will literally just grab my phone. If I've come up with something good, hit the little voice memo on it, record my piano, record my vocal, and I've got some kind of a little sketch that I can come back to. But similar to what Don's saying, when I do go into Cakewalk, I do have project templates that I've set up. Cakewalk actually has a bunch of templates that are set up. There's one for mastering, there's one for project template, whatever, right? But I've actually customized them to my particular thing. And I've always got one track called Vocals that's wired to my first, and I only have a two-channel interface. So One called Vocals is plugged into the first one. Second one's called Guitar. It's plugged into the second interface. I have my default piano virtual instrument loaded up. And then I can literally just, you know, figure out what the tempo is and start recording a little piano ditty to whatever the song is. And again, like I was saying before, if I save it as, I don't know the title yet, just give it some random title that is somehow meaningful. And then you can come back to it later. But templates, That's one of my big tips, is template the heck out of your thing. Because like Don's saying, like groups, you can group a whole bunch of tracks and make a track template out of that. So if I need to insert that favorite synth pad that I like, boom, it's in. If I need if I want the Abbey Road drums with the multiple outputs from Contact all set up and named properly so that when I do record to them, the file names are named correctly in the file folder, all that sort of stuff. You can just template it and one click and it's boom, it's all there for you. So it takes a little bit of effort to set all this stuff up, but once you do it, it makes your life so much easier. You can then focus on the creative and not worry about, 12 microphone inputs and how they're configured.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. You don't want to be bogged down with technical nonsense when you're when the music is coming. Right?
Exactly.
What do you do,
when you're
Mike?
In the creative headspace? Well, I don't even start recording till I've got a song figured out.
Yeah.
And then when I lay it down, I change it. sometimes I even to a click track, I'll play acoustic guitar and sing on one track just so I have a guide. And then I'll go back in and do a proper acoustic, depending on what the song is, but I've been mostly recording on an acoustic for a long time. So I'll go back and record one acoustic track, and then I'll do a separate guide vocal, and then I'll do other guitar passes, and then maybe then I'll send it to someone for bass or drums, or maybe I'll do the whole thing with loops and add more. But that's about the only difference than what, you know, I think, you know, having the beat or the drum track helps, but I'm not always sure the tempo. So sometimes I'll record a couple of different versions to see what is the best feel for the song. And sometimes, you know, in recording it, I find the song, you know, especially when I'm playing it just by myself, I can't do anything really fancy because I'm trying to remember the song. I'm trying to play the chords. I'm trying to sing and all this at once. But once it's separated in a recording, then I can spend more time on, you know, doing the vocals and doing vocal harmonies and doing the guitar track and actually having a little bit more business in the guitar. And so I like that process, but it's almost like I record two ways. I record a live off the floor just to capture it. And sometimes I do that as acoustically well as I can, mic it well. But once I get into the recording, that song can change dramatically.
Well, one of the things I usually do with singer-songwriters when I work with them is I'll ask them to send me even just a phone recording of their song, just so I know what the groove is and what the tempo is. Mm-hmm. And I'll set up a drum loop for them to play along to. And the first thing I'll do is set up one microphone in front of them, a few feet away, and one track, and record a scratch track. Them singing and playing the guitar at the same time to the drum beat so that it's locked into time. And that's your sort of scratch track. You're going to get rid of this at the end of the day, because then what you're going to do is do what they call a telephone EQ on that track to make it sound smaller. You cut away a lot of the highs and the lows.
Yeah.
And you play that back for the singer-songwriter with the headphones on. Now they had headphones on before to listen to the drum track. But so they follow along with their song. They know exactly where they are, but then they can focus on just recording the guitar track. And I can focus on miking the guitar properly now and doing it, you know, with some intention, and then repeat for the vocal and backups and all the rest of it. And then you can get rid of that scratch track, and there you go.
So that's kind of the same process. Mm-hmm. But definitely finding the right drum track. I've heard actors talk about, like De Niro says, sometimes it's just finding the right shoes, and definitely finding the right drum, like rhythm track, makes a huge difference. Like, I forget what song it was, but Neil, you did the drum track for me, and I was really, I think it was actually the song challenge this year. Mm-hmm. And I wasn't really digging it. I couldn't make it work. And then you gave me a drum track for it, and all of a sudden it made sense and it grooved, and I didn't hate it anymore. And that's often the case. But right. a good drum track makes a huge difference, you know.
I did want to mention, though, something. And this happened a lot, you know, back in the day when you actually had to go into a, you know, full recording studio and you'd spend money, you know, with your band. And the problem, mm-hmm. and one thing that I think it's important to keep in mind, that, you know, being a musician involves a lot of different skills. I mean, there's the skill in the of playing the instrument. There's the skill of performing, which is different than playing your instrument, performing for other people. But also being able to record is a skill, and it's a separate skill, and it is something you have to develop. So when you are starting your home recording journey, you know, it's going to take a while for you to get comfortable with recording yourself and hearing yourself. And the only way you get better at it is just by doing it over and over and over again. So just record yourself a lot. It doesn't have to be great. It's not going to be perfect. Even if you're going to trash it, but just get used to that process. So that way, you know, when you hit record, and back in the days when people would go in this, you know, in the studio, and, you know, you'd be working with an engineer, and they'd start playing, you know, they'd hit the record button, people would tense up. Mm. And, you know, and then their performance would suck, and it would be such an unpleasant experience because they had never done it before. And they may have been fantastic playing live and in front of people, but playing in a studio is so different. So just take the time, and it's a skill like anything else. Just get used to recording yourself, even a dumb little song, or, you know, just anything. Just get used to the process of recording yourself and hearing yourself.
And kind of related to that, but like the fact of the matter is that music, like we're saying before, recording in your home is extraordinarily accessible today, more so than it's ever been. And it has been the case for, like, you know, 10, 20 years now, that you can record at home relatively affordably, and you can get, like Don's saying, gear acquisition syndrome, where you feel like, if only I had X, then my recordings would be better. If only I had the right preamp, the right plug-in, the right microphone, the right whatever. But in support of what Phil's saying, what I've learned over the years that I've been doing this is that the biggest roadblock is your own skill, right? Like, I can actually be victim of the plugin recording thing where I got to have that plugin. I got a new instrument. Oh, yeah. It's so cool. It's great. I really need this. I need this. And lately I get hounded by ads from Waves, from Native Instruments, from Arturia, from all these plugin companies. And I look at them and usually that's the time I do click on them, because it's fun just to see what new thing is out. And I'm like, no, you know what? I have that already. I know how to do that without the fancy business that they're doing. I know how to do it. You know, they've combined six plugins into one plugin, but I already know how to do it using the six plugins I have. Right. So that's another tip, really, is to learn what you've got. Cause if you buy a software package and an audio interface that comes with a software package and a microphone and headphones, and you kind of got, you know, a starter kit, until you can get like a good sounding recording out of that, you shouldn't be upgrading anything. You shouldn't be buying anything new. It's all there. And if you can get it done with, you know, your built-in software compressors and EQs and reverbs, you're there. And you don't necessarily need, the solution is not usually, I need to buy X. The solution is, I need to work harder at this and get it right.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's absolutely true. I bought a lot of plugins, and from that company, Waves.
Yes, we all have.
Who always? Oh, they're kind of a bit evil. No, they're not.
But
they have some good plugins. But I started going through, and a lot of the stuff I use, I started making a list of all the plugins that I've used from them. Like I have like tons of them, and the ones that I really use and really like. And the reason is Waves is notorious for making you upgrade all the time. So eventually when I go to M1 Max, because I probably will at one point, I have Pentiums right now, they're probably going to say, oh, you need version R13. And to get those next levels, you have to pay them some fee for licensing.
And it's the same plugin.
Exactly. It's the same plugin, but it won't work on the new M1 or something like that. So I'm making a list, and all the ones that I use a lot, I'll buy only those ones.
Smart.
The hell with buying the big premium bundle packets, because I have some of those. So there's another way of saving money. But really, you don't need any additional plugins when you get started. Like I can only speak for Logic, but there's plenty of great plugins in Logic. You know what I really like Logic for? Their compressors. They are fantastic. They've modeled them after all these different types of hardware, plus they have a clean one, which is all digital, and they sound really good. They really do a great job. And I've heard pros who are in the business that use Logic, and they say, yeah, I use the Logic compressor. I like it the best. So really, there's a lot of power in all the DIWs, whatever you're using. You don't really need to run out and get more plugins. I would say learn the plugins that are in the software really well. And then maybe, okay, I want to get that one or that one because you've tried it, or you can demo them a lot of times too, which is really helpful.
Right? And figure out, like when you're talking about compressors, like figure out what those knobs actually mean. Like I used compressors for many, many years before I knew how to use the attack knob with intention, to use a release knob with intention, to actually know what the sound quality was going to result in. Because otherwise it's just, you're just loading up a preset that may or may not work with the track you're trying to do it on. So again, that's knowledge based. Every compressor is kind of the same in that way. Some of them don't have attack and release knobs. What does that mean? Does it have a slow attack or a fast attack built into it? Like those CLA-2As, they've all got a medium attack. Those are the sorts of details that you have to be aware of before you upgrade to the better plugin to actually say, I have actually hit a wall that I can't do what I want to do. Okay, now I might need that additional plugin so I get that actual functionality.
Yeah, it's not the equipment. It's really about your skill set. And one of the issues, I think, when you start is you're recording a track and it's not working the way you want it. So you start just kind of trying stuff because you don't know. And that's a bit. So you start putting plugins and go, okay. And then after a while, it just becomes a huge mess because you just got so much junk on it, you know? And that's sometimes having too many plugins can actually think, well, you know, this sounds like Abbey Road. Well, yeah, but so, because I bought the same plugin that Nick Blagona used on a session that I was, that he did for me. And I can tell you that, like, he knew what that plugin did, and he got it to do it perfectly. And then I bought it and I realized, you know what? I really don't know what this, I know what it does, but I didn't know how to work it quite as well as he did because, you know, so it's really the skill, and not so much the plugin. And,
yeah, absolutely.
And that's where these template things come in really handy too. Cause like one of the greatest features about Cakewalk by BandLab is that I think Logic has this too. I'm not entirely sure. It's got a channel strip built into every track by default. And you can customize the channel strip any way you want. And you can sort of right click in the channel strip and say, make this my default. So every time you open up a new track, like I've got it configured so that there's an EQ at the top. Then there's the standard compressor. There's a bin for any other effects that I want to drag into it, like delays and things. There's a saturation knob that's my go-to saturation knob. And then there's we call the channel saturation thing at the end of the chain, which means I'm always using that same compressor. Unless I've got a reason to use a different one, then you're always going to the same one. So you begin to learn how that particular plugin works and how it behaves and what it does when you switch the knob this way or switch the knob that way. And you get a feel for it. And that, again, that's just practice and doing it over and over and over again and using the same tools. If you've got, you know, 70 different compressors and you just pick one at random for every different project, you're never going to learn the nuances of that particular, any one of them, you know?
Yeah. And once you know one compressor well, you're probably going to learn the next one very quickly.
That's true too. Yes. Okay. Yeah.
How about you, Michael? Do you have any kind of Logic tips that you wanted to share?
No. well, I haven't gotten the templates, which I think I should look at. But it definitely keeping it simple. I have been working just with what came with Logic, and a few others, but I bought a few because they did something that Logic didn't, especially kind of mastering the stuff, and then there was somewhere else. But I forget who brought it up, but if you can't get it in the room, if you can't get it sounding good really early on, it doesn't matter how many layers and things you put on it. You're just sort of hiding the issue. The song and the playing should be good first, and then you're taking that and making something of it.
Mic placement, especially for acoustic instruments or whatever, mic placement makes a huge difference.
Thankfully, there's YouTube, and YouTube has a lot of tutorials about how to mic guitars, and you know, so it's a great resource for you. But one thing that I'm very sad about is that they no longer have printed manuals when you get your DAWs. And I went through all my manuals, and I used to be an Apple Systems consultant, and the reason I was actually an Apple Systems consultant was because I actually read the manuals, and I could swear that most people could have done what I did if they just read the darn manuals, but they wouldn't. And so I would have a manual, and it would have like tons of sticky notes in it and highlights and folded over pages. And, you know, while I was sitting on the couch, I'd be going through the manual, which is a different way of experience. You know, usually if you're looking at a manual, you're working on something and you just want an answer. But being able to browse a manual is a very different experience, and you get to learn about the program in a kind of a deeper, kind of more organic way. Mm-hmm. I would buy manuals for the stuff that, for the programs I have, but most of them don't do it. I mean, you can read them on an iPad or a tablet, and that's a little bit better, but it's not quite the same.
Mm-hmm. You could print it out, I guess.
You could, I suppose.
A lot of paper.
Manual is like 800 pages or something.
Yeah, my Logic Logic manuals used to be that thick.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Don't get them anymore. I had a big box like this, and it weighed like, I don't know, like 5 or 10 pounds or something. It's ridiculous. I mean,
these days, I actually prefer the online... the online help system, because you can search it like you can't with a printed manual. But back in the day when I was getting started, the Cakewalk Sonar manual was pretty cumbersome. And I actually bought like a third party, it was called Sonar Power by Scott Garrigus, a book that takes you through step by step how to set up tracks and how to do this and that, much more user friendly and that sort of thing. So that was an invaluable book. I got like, you know, that was like version 3, like 15 years ago. And since then, I haven't needed the manual. It's just one of the new features. Okay.
Yeah.
I just poke around and experiment. I usually find what I want eventually.
Yeah.
Yeah. I wanted to ask your opinion on something. So you've got a track that you've recorded and you come to it the next week. When you open up that track, do you save like a revision of that? So that you have sort of like a a version that is, you know, what you did before and then changes on top of that. So you might have Phil's song 1, Phil's song 2, or Phil's song 3. Or do you guys just do it all in one track?
I do it. I set it up, and then every time I save it, I have the name of the song and then year, month, day. So I'll do that every single day.
So
and sometimes if I get to a point where I want to make a drastic change, I'll in the same day, I'll call it B for the same day. And that's the way I catalog it. And that way I can always go back to a certain day and bring that song up and it'll be in that state.
So every day you save a version.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
Until I get to the end. Cause sometimes what I'll do is I'll go back to stuff later and I'll bring the old file up and I'll start it again, but I'll start it clean and I'll clean it all out and just keep the latest revision. But then all the old stuff will be left on the hard drive.
Right. Yeah.
So I could always go back to, I'm actually doing that right now with a bunch of stuff from 2005.
Oh, wow.
And I didn't find all my synthesizer sounds. You were talking about that earlier.
Yeah.
I did manage, I actually did dig and I finally found them, but, something I've been doing for the last few years is I tick all the boxes on the assets. And what it does is it brings in, as you're saying, Phil, it brings all the assets in. So even though you've got that loop stored in the C drive, it's also stored in the project folder.
Yeah, yeah.
So,
and in Cakewalk, it's really good in the preferences. There's a setting. It's not on by default, I don't think. But you have to click auto save every X number of minutes. So I usually set it to 10 minutes or 10 changes.
Yeah.
And it does an auto save. And also you can select versioning and you can select how many versions you'd like to save. And then directly in the folder, it creates these extra files that step back every time you saved or every time it's auto saved. So you can have, you know, as many versions back as you want to go back to. So it kind of happens automatically for me. So I don't worry about it too much. And there has been times where something's got corrupted or something's gone really, really wrong. And I'm like, okay, let me check the versions. And okay, there was one from yesterday. Fine. Restore it.
I've had corrupt songs before. Yeah. And had to go back to the...
It happens.
Yeah.
It happens.
And especially sometimes you've just kind of accidentally captured some kind of mixing thing and it just sounds great. And it has a certain aspect. And then you play around with it and then you lose it. And that allows you to kind of get back to that. And I've done that a few times as well, you know.
Okay. You know? So we've covered a lot. And, of course, there's a lot more we can surely talk about with specific programs and things like that. But like Phil said, especially, there's a lot of YouTube content out there. Look up your specific DAW and guaranteed there's Facebook groups and YouTube videos and probably one of your friends is using it. So there's lots of resources out there. You don't have to bang your head against your monitor too much. You can probably find the help you need. So that's about it for tonight. Thank you, Don, for coming on the show.
Thank you back, Don.
Yeah, it's good to see you, Don.
And listeners, we'd love to hear from you. So please send us your comments or your questions on Twitter, Facebook, or Instagram at Song Talk Radio, or send us an email at feedback@songtalk.ca, or hit the Q&A form on the website and send us your question that way. Also, be sure to check out our YouTube channel for live performance videos and full episodes now that we're all virtual in boxes. And subscribe today to the Song Talk Radio podcast on your favorite podcast provider. And don't forget to sign up for a free newsletter at songtalk.ca. You'll find links to all the products, books, and web services we mentioned on Song Talk Radio on our resources page on the website. And wherever you are in the world, please join us online via Zoom at our next monthly Song Talk meetup. It's free to join on meetup.com and free to attend. Stop by songtalk.ca for the link. You can follow me at neilmody.com. You can follow Phil
at philemery.ca.
And you can follow Michael.
Proudfoot420 on Instagram.
And Mr. Don Thompson.
Don Thompson, 777 on Twittergram.
Twittergram. Oh, cool. Thanks for listening, everybody. Be sure to stop by the website, songtalk.ca, to browse past shows and find out how you can be a guest. Stay safe, everyone, and keep on writing.
Keep on recording.
Keep on recording.
Good night.
And don't buy that plugin. You don't need that plugin.
You don't need the damn plugin.
You don't need it. There we go. There's the outro lights.
That's what you need. You need that. You should buy.
You
should
disco lights.
You need this. Lights you need.
That's pretty cool.
Awesome. I think my nebula cloud, it exploded.
Green light.
Meanwhile, I'm heading into darkness.
Oh, dark matter.